This is Rabbi Josh Uter, and welcome to the relaunch of my podcast series, What's the Point of the Midrash? Wow. It's been far too long since I've done this, so I think a little bit of an introduction is in order. Several years ago, not long after I had made Aliyah, I started a podcast series called What's the Point of the Midrash? I had some sort of experience with podcasting before. From 2008 to 2014, I was the rabbi of the Stanton Street Shul on the Lower East Side of New York. And in 2011, I started recording my classes and posting them online as podcasts with the audio and source sheets hosted on my personal site, joshuter.com. These classes were usually part of a larger series, such as The Politics of Exclusion, where we studied a history of communal exclusion from the Bible to the modern era, or the Halachic Process series, where we tried to provide a systematic approach to Jewish law, always being mindful of the questions of authority, or there was Current Jewish Questions, which addressed contemporary issues. These classes were designed to be standalone, such that people could pick any class and be able to follow along, even in the middle. This was done out of necessity, because I wanted congregants to be able to come to class at any time and not feel like they missed out on a bunch of prerequisites or came in the middle of a conversation. And I think this approach, as well as the engagement of the congregants, really helped these classes gain some sort of followers online. At least it was for me for that scale and at that time. For anyone interested, all of those classes are still online at my site, joshuter.com. When I left the professional rabbinate in 2014 to make Aliyah, I had to get a real job. The downside to that is my Torah output, of course, took a significant hit. Wasn't able to write as much, wasn't able to podcast as much, wasn't able to even just sit and think about things in the way that I used to. One way that I tried to keep up on things was to do a podcast. And I'd always felt I did a little bit better when I was playing off other people in conversation, like, for example, my congregants. Don't want to say that they posed a foil, though some did, but the exchange I always felt was a little more interesting and always sparked new ideas in my head, and it made things a little bit more lively. So my plan at the time was to hit up various friends of mine in Jerusalem for guest spots, so it wouldn't just be me. It would give me someone to play off of, which I thought would make for a more interesting conversation for people to listen in on. And given the diversity of my friends, could really offer a wide range of perspectives. And I had some really wonderful conversations with brilliant friends of mine. I think, if I remember correctly, we managed to get through Sefer Bereshit, and at that point I just couldn't keep up with it. It's hard enough trying to do creative work while holding down a full-time job, being solely responsible for the content and the technology, but trying to do all that while also being the program director and managing guests, several of whom bailed at the last minute, just became far too taxing. And because of that, I just let it go because I just couldn't keep up with it. So this time around, I've decided to try going at it solo, at least initially, see if that'll work any better, and also try to keep my aims a little less ambitious in the hopes of trying to be more consistent with something. The goal is to try to keep up through this year's Parsha cycle, and hopefully I can keep up with decent semblance of quality that listeners may find enjoyable, entertaining, and even more important, thought-provoking. And we'll see, hopefully, how that works. Format may change. I really don't know. This is just me trying to start this up again because, frankly, I've missed it. So it's, you know, hopefully you guys get something out of this. But this is also for me, too, because it's something which I do miss terribly from my time in the rabbinate. And, you know, it'll take a bit of effort for me to try to get back to it, but hopefully it's going to be worth it for everyone involved. Because it's been such a long time since I did anything on Midrash, and also, frankly, not a whole lot of people listened to the first go-round, so, you know, things people might have missed, but at the beginning, I introduced the whole what's the point of the Midrash concept. So if you've heard it before, you feel free to skip the rest of this. If you haven't, here's what goes on. Here's what the whole deal is behind it. For me, it goes back to my undergraduate days at Yeshiva University. For 2.5 years, I was in the shiur, the class of Rabbi Moshe Tendler. And every Thursday, he would take some time out of the regular Gemara Talmud portion to teach something out of Midrash Rabbah related to that week's Parsha. He really enjoyed teaching Midrash and Agadah, the homiletic stuff. Even in the Gemara, where there would be certain homiletic passages that weren't about nitty-gritty details of law, that might have been skipped in certain other schools, his approach was, if they thought it was important enough to put it in, it should be important enough for us to learn. And the way that he would teach Midrash Rabbah was very close to Rambam's, the Maimonidean ideal of not taking these teachings either purely literally or figuratively, but rather trying to find out the truth of the message that a particular teaching was trying to convey. And I appreciated this approach so much, I copied it just blatantly, with credit, in my synagogue, in the Stanton Street Shul for my Friday night Dvar Torah. And the way that I did there was more of an open conversation with the congregation. It was small enough that it was possible. And we really got to explore the possibilities of what a midrash could mean or might mean. And because it was an open conversation, ideas came out all over the place that were fantastic. And it gave me the opportunity to teach how to study Midrash by example. As people gave interpretations, I could show strengths and limitations of these interpretations, pointing out what problems they solve, what problems left open, and what new problems they might have introduced, what the basis for some interpretations would be. And at the end, we had some really wonderful, amazing discussions on a whole host of topics, because the range of Midrashic topics is really endless. And I enjoyed it immensely, and I thought it would seem like a good format for a podcast. So that's really the origins of where this comes in. And I should at this point also say a few words of introduction about Midrash and Midrash Rabbah. Not everyone knows what these things are. So the word midrash comes from the Hebrew word doresh, or to expound. Refers to teachings of exegesis, that is scriptural interpretation. These interpretations generally come in two categories, midrash halacha and midrash agada. Midrash halacha is what we would call legal exegesis, which means it refers to biblical interpretations that are supposed to be normative, meaning these are not just how we interpret the Bible, but this is how we interpret the Bible as a matter of law. So for one example, when the Bible says an eye for an eye, the Midrash Halacha teaches that that doesn't refer to corporal punishment, that we literally take out someone's eye, but rather to monetary payment for injury. This would be an example of a Midrash Halacha. In contrast, Midrash Agadah refers to homiletical interpretations, which tend not to carry the same force of law in the sense of obligating practice or even belief. Most often when people refer to, quote, a Midrash or the Midrash without any qualification, they're referring to one of these homiletical teachings. I should say here, for any academics who are listening and might catch me on this, in the interest of full disclosure, the line between Agadah and Halacha, the homiletical and the legal, is neither clear nor absolute. There's a lot written on this, and it's an important area of study, but it's far beyond the current scope here. The specific collection of works known as Midrash Rabbah are anthologies of these Midrashei Agadav homiletic teachings, though occasionally you will find some halachic teachings in there, particularly in the book of Devarim Rabba on Deuteronomy, that often begins with some halachic teaching, though the teachings have sources elsewhere, say in the Talmud. So it isn't, say, the source of the law, but rather mentions the law. These teachings of Midrash Rabba are associated and divided up by the five books of Torah, of Bereishit, Shmot, Vayikra, Bemidbar, Devarim, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, as well as the five Megillot, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, Esther, Rut, Echa, Lamentations, and Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. These books contain teachings attributed to various rabbinic sages of the Tannaitic and Amoraic periods, the same periods that we know from the Mishnah and the Talmud, respectively. The compilations of the books vary a great deal. Some books of Midrash Rabba were published earlier and later than others, some long after the closing of the Talmud. Some of the teachings in Midrash Rabba have parallels in earlier rabbinic works, like, say, the Talmud, either the Babylonian or Jerusalem, the Bavli Yerushalmi Talmuds, or even elsewhere in Midrash Rabba. Sometimes you may even find the same Midrash will appear multiple times within Bereishit Rabba itself. Other Midrashim don't have parallels elsewhere. But these are the volumes that we have, and this is what's in them. The size of the volumes varies greatly. So, for example, Bereishit Rabba on the Book of Genesis is massive. In the set of Midrash Rabba that I have, the section on Parshat Bereishit alone, the very first one, takes up pretty much, I think, one whole volume on its own. And we can kind of understand why, given, you know, how much homiletical teachings you're going to find on creation. On the other hand, Devarim Rabba on Deuteronomy is relatively small, so it's not weighted exactly, you know, it's not weighted, you know, evenly amongst all of these sources. May also mean why doing this for more than 1 year may pose a little bit more challenging, given, you know, some parts of Midrash Rabba have immense amounts of material, other parts not as much. Want to get through 1 year, we'll see how it goes. If we change later, so be it. More interesting, in my opinion, than the differences in size of these volumes is the wide range of opinions that you're going to find in the Midrashei Agadah. And this is something to which not many people are exposed. For many people, I find, the only Midrashim that they're aware of, or the ones most prominent that come to mind, are the ones cited by the medieval commentator Rashi. For those unfamiliar, Rashi, medieval commentator, probably the most, you know, well-known, and I would say the most commonly studied one, not very original as far as a commentator, as much as he cites rabbinic sources, often from Midrash Rabba, from from the Talmud or other rabbinic texts, as opposed to coming up with his own unique interpretation, though the selection of which Midrash he decides to cite, you could say, is a form of interpretation on its own. But if you only read Rashi and you're reading these rabbinic midrashic texts, you may be unaware that another rabbinic text in the same volume, just, you know, maybe even one paragraph over, might make the exact opposite point. Such that just by reading Rashi, certainly valuable, and I would highly encourage everyone do it, but it is by no means the last or only word on rabbinic interpretations on any given verse. You'll also find people who will, you know, in one idiom, quote, mine Jewish texts to find the nuggets of ideas that happen to coincide with their worldview. And then they can present it as, hey, look, Judaism says this. And that way they can also gleefully ignore any other text that contradicts their worldview. And again, if this is all that you know, you're going to come, or this is all you're going to be taught, you're going to come away with a very skewed perspective of what rabbinic thought actually entails and incorporates. In reality, just as the rabbinic sages argued on matters of halakha and matters of law, they argued on matters of machshava, or Jewish thought, philosophy, and theology. And those disputes, I don't think, get as much attention as I think they should, or that I would, you know, personally like, which is, again, another good reason to do this. And at the same time, you know, there's a quote I like from the physicist Niels Bohr, at least attributed to him, that the opposite of a fact is a falsehood, but the opposite of one profound truth may well be another profound truth. My goal in What's the Point of the Midrash is not to paskin dogma, or to say, here's what Judaism really believes on anything, or to treat Midrashim as either a literal fact or homiletic analogies. The point is to try to figure out what profound truths the sages were trying to teach us in these teachings. I'm not going to be offering solutions as much as making suggestions or offering possibilities. Maybe you like mine, maybe you won't. Maybe you'll even come up with something better. As far as I'm concerned, anything that gets people thinking just a little bit more about Torah and expanding their knowledge of the wide range of rabbinic Judaism, for me, that's a win. And hopefully, What's the Point of the Midrash might do that for you. Thank you for listening to the introductory podcast, and we will start with Bereshit coming up next.